Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Well, hello, good evening. I'm Ruth Aramarte Fio, and this is the first hour of Feed Your Head. And I'm so lucky to have with me Dr. Comrade Howley. He's out doing lectures and talks in many areas of the world, actually. So it's good that he's back home in his home base in Chicago, and we've got him. Hello, Muhammad.
Hi, Ruthann. Hi, how are you?
I am great. Right before the show, we were talking about our weather in Illinois, and you're still having a bit of winter, and I'm talking spring, so I don't
know. Very soon we will have a spring weather. It's inevitable. It's coming. It's late, but it will come.
It's coming.
It's coming.
And springtime in Chicago is lovely. So tonight we're going to talk about several things, but they're all encompassed by the title of your book, The Fall of Capitalism and Rise of Islam. And, you know, the two are written about extensively, but separately.
Exactly, yeah.
And so this is maybe the only, if not the only, one of the very few books that has put the two together.
Right. I think, in fact, this is, I mentioned this in the book, there is lots of talk about capitalism, what's wrong with capitalism, the fall of capitalism. There are many writings about Islam and the rise of Islam. In fact, there is a recent book came out of Harvard professor, I forgot the name of the author, called The Fall and the Rise of the Islamic State. But then to put these together as trends, which I look at it as a trend in history. History has lots of trends.
Mm-hmm.
Like at the beginning of the last century, there was the rise of a new era of socialism and communism and the Soviet Union at the time when the First World War was evading. So there was a new world, an old order was fading away with the with the Germans, British, French fighting, and then here is a new Soviet Union coming. So there are trends in history.
Yeah.
And so I think now what I tried to depict in this book is this new phenomenon, which is there is the capitalism, which is the main ideology of the Western world, and then this old ideology of the East, of the Orient, if you will, Islam. So there is this type of trend which I try to cover in this book. Yeah, I think you depicted this right.
Right, and you did. The book is very interesting. I'd like to give a little background on you. You actually went to high school a year as an exchange student in Illinois.
That's correct, yeah.
You went to the Soviet Union for 6 years.
That's true.
And you got your bachelor's there. You got your master's in Jordan, which was actually where you were born.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got your PhD back in Illinois at the U of I in Champaign.
That's correct, yeah. I'm proud of this, that I have the three views, which came handy to me. So I know the view of capitalism right from the heart of the capitalist world in America.
Yeah.
I knew socialism right in the heart of the country that claimed to be socialist or communist, at least, which is the Soviet Union.
Right.
And I was born and got educated in the heart of the Muslim world, where Islam was and continues to be the main religion or idea of the
right.
of the land.
Yeah, I am glad that you said where communism or socialism, or where the country claimed to be communist or socialism, because as far as I've been able to find, we've never really had a country that was truly, truly
communist country.
Or socialist.
Well, yeah, although my book is about capitalism, sometimes I like to dwell on socialism.
Mm-hmm.
When when the revolution took place in the Soviet Union in 1917, October of 1917, which is the main revolution. There were a couple of revolutions before, attempts before that. When Lenin came into power, he brought the idea of communism cannot be immediately implemented, so let's divert the idea of Marx and Engels from so-called communism into socialism.
Right.
And then he claimed that socialism is a country in which by design it has to lead the nation or the world into communism, which never happened, of course. The Soviet Union collapsed before they were able to achieve that.
Yeah.
So that's a fact of history, which is not, people, even the communists or socialists, do not deny that.
Right. Well, now, you said that you were born and your early childhood spent in Jordan. Islamic nation, basically. And was your family very religious? I mean,
well, let me just make one quick statement here. My family, I was born in a village in the northern part of Jordan. The village is historically a religious group of people who live there, which is most of the people who live are relatives. So it's like my name comes from Malkawi, from the village Malka. So the majority of the people who live there, they carry the same last name.
Mm-hmm.
And they are religious because of all types of historical reasons. However, religion in the last maybe 100 years or a little bit less than 100 years, not only in Jordan, but in the majority of the, in all over the Muslim world, religion has been totally separated from the real life of the people. So religion is mostly ritual. But the things which I am talking about in the book, the economy and the economic system and the political system, were stripped away from the life of the people, if you will. So the country is secular by design, by system, by, in fact, or even by ideology of the state. But the people, they are religious because of what they believe in. However, to reflect on that, I grew up in Jordan, and by the time when I went to the Soviet Union, when the Soviets or the socialists were challenging us with ideas of atheism, none of the students, so-called Muslim students, were able to defend the ideas of the religion. People are not even educated about their own religion in my country.
Yeah,
and they were not able to rationalize the thoughts about the religion because the country is secular. It's just like the United States. Christians are Christians in the church, but once they are out of the church, they are pure capitalists.
Right. You would never know because they're not walking their talk.
Yes, exactly. Once you walk in the church, you are very much into Jesus, into Christ, everything. You get out of the church, you are as a Rockefeller, as Goldman Sachs, as those big bankers, as much as you can.
Right, right. It's all about greed. And the idea that you would help a homeless person or a family that needs food, you know, people might mouth this in church, but once they're out, it doesn't happen to the degree it should.
Yeah, no. You pay your dues. Let's say I pay a few dollars, a few bucks here and there I put it in a box in a church or in a mosque, then that's it. I am done.
Right.
But your buck, your dollar, probably, maybe it has fed one person, but you know that there are 850 million people who are still without food, hungry.
Right.
And that, your dollar in the church or in the mosque or in the synagogue for that matter, is not going to feed or to eliminate the poverty. And now going back, now I just want to jump into the main issue of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Poverty, which is poverty means that there are some people who are deprived of their needs, of their ability to satisfy their needs.
Right.
In capitalism, under capitalism, it's a fact of life. It's not something that you live without. And that goes back to the theory of relative scarcity, which Adam Smith came up with, and Ricardo, and they thought they brought something like a godly thing, which is a myth, I think, because in reality, what we know today, the resources in the world, the food that exists in the world, is more than enough to feed the world time and time again.
Right.
And this is a fact.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know where the heck he thought that the amount of goods are less than what the people really need. That's ridiculous. And based on that now, that's a theory that upon which a whole system is built, meaning that there will always be a time when some people will not be able to get some of the resources, some of the goods, which means they will be poor. So poverty is part of the system. The system generates the ideas about poverty.
Exactly.
And that,
like I said, there's plenty. There is plenty to go around. It's not allocated right. And when you have corporations in charge, it's not going to be.
Yeah, it's the resource distribution that's a problem. It's not the resource quantity or quality. When someone owns, which is really, it's mind-boggling, somebody has in his account $100 billion. What is $100 billion doing in the account of one person? That's ridiculous.
Right.
I'm not against people being rich, but when the richness or the wealth goes beyond the ability of the mind to comprehend, something is wrong. Something is wrong. When the money that accumulates in the hands of the few is really being depleted from the hands of the multitude, of the large crowd, that is the problem, I think. And I think capitalism, that goes even when I say in the book, the crisis of capitalism is not a matter of a crisis that will go away. It's a matter of continuous crisis that will eventually bring this whole system of capitalism to a halt, to collapse. Because
that was what I was going to ask you. You know, we've had different hiccups in our system before.
Yeah.
Why isn't this particular one in capitalism, why isn't it just another passing thing
well,
to recover from?
Yeah. Number one, sometimes I like to borrow some of the things which I learned from the Marxist theory, although I don't believe in them all, though some of them are good to use.
Yes.
Like there are some, it's called accumulative errors. When the accumulative errors, like crisis plus, crisis recover, but nevertheless the crisis leaves scars on the system. So the accumulation of crisis over time leads to a total qualitative change, which means a collapse. This is a crisis like the ones that we had in the beginning of 2000, which is called the internet bubble. It's another crisis which was in 87 when the black market, the Black Monday collapse, and it's before that sometimes in the late 60s and then the 29 or the Second World War and so on. Those are it's a chain of elements which shows a trend, and this trend is not fading away. That's one. Second issue is this time around, the things that have led to the current major crisis, they are detrimental in the sense that they cannot be recovered. And here is the example.
Okay.
Number one, when the Nixon administration departed away from the gold standard in 1971 for the sake because the amount of dollars that were generated is way beyond what the United States can afford to pay in gold, so they detached the dollar from the gold, and eventually, of course, the whole currencies of the world, they were detached from the gold. This allowed the amount of virtual wealth to grow beyond or without any limitation. Second, there was the banking deregulations, which was done by Reagan in the early 80s, where he also detached the economic growth from the actual financial growth. And so they detached the economy from the money. In other words, money can grow. You can have more money than your actual economic growth. Economic growth in the United States was on the average 4 to 5% over the last 50 years per year, but the amount of money wealth that was accumulated or generated by the Federal Reserve, it's in trillions of dollars, way beyond what the economy has grown.
Right.
So now, in order to when these two issues hit the market or hit the economy, the only way to recover is to reverse those big serious mistakes. But no one in his right mind or in his bad mind is willing even to address these issues, because there is an amount of wealth today that the Federal Reserve, which is, for the surprise of many people, it's a privately owned federal.
Exactly. People in this country actually think that the Federal Reserve is
federal. It's anything but federal.
Yes, yes.
And then I think when I was looking at this issue, Woodrow Wilson back in 1915, he gave the mandate for creating the Federal Reserve. And it's reported, I'm still trying to find a document really that certifies that, 1929, when the collapse happened, just a few months before he died, he mentioned that this was the biggest crime he ever committed against the American nation.
Ah, he admitted it.
Well, he did admit that this was, I have it in my book. I have some reports on that, but I yet to find the real original document for that. This has gone in the literature, in the history, that he did admit the guilt of giving the mandate for the bunch of people to hold the right to issue currency in the United States and to hold the monetary system, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So that, with the power of the Federal Reserve, the power they have, the amount of their power over the government, that means there is no way in the world they will allow any solution that will eventually reduce the amount of wealth they claim to have, which is virtual wealth. So this takes me to the main point which I have in the book. The creation of virtual economy or virtual wealth against the real economy is the key disastrous issue, is the key. And that is what we call in computer engineering, which is, I'm a computer engineer. When this happens, we say there is a thrashing. The system thrashes or it goes to trash if the virtual world overwhelms the real world, which is the case today.
Okay.
So that today, I think that the United States and Europe, the leaders of capitalism, they have enjoyed the growth of virtual money and virtual wealth irrespective of the growth of the economy. You have economy is not growing at a given or acceptable rate, but the money continues to be to grow.
Yeah.
And then also, if you look at, and I have a chart in my book that shows the GDP, the gross domestic product, or the GNP,
mm-hmm.
which continues to grow, and today it's in trillions of dollars, and the number of poor people continue to grow too. So the wealth has not helped reducing the problem of poverty.
Not a bit. In fact, it's actually been increasing. More people are, like now they say 1 in 4 American children goes to bed hungry.
That's true, yeah.
We've never had that in this country. I mean, it's actually getting worse. I wanted to ask you about that virtual economy, but you've pretty much, you've explained that. But what about the gold standard? You mentioned the Federal Reserve. And does the gold standard have any place in the world? I mean, it seems like it does in some countries, but in this country anymore, does it?
No. Well, in 1971, I think here is the history. The history is very interesting. After the Second World War, the United States wanted to pull out Europe out of the mess it got itself into, and they built the so-called the Marshall Plan. Marshall Plan was to lend Europe lots of dollars in order to help them recreate their economy, which it did. Mm-hmm. So between 1945 and 1965, about 20 years, Europe had accumulated lots of dollars, and the United States was giving them lots of cash in order to make their economy grow. Now, also in the meantime, United States under Bretton Woods Agreement, that they were supposed to exchange the dollars, $35 per ounce of gold. So this was the advertised rate. Mm-hmm. So by 1965 or late 60s, let's say, the amount of dollars that Europe had was way beyond what the entire gold reserve the United States has can afford. So here comes the issue: is let's detach the gold from the dollar so that no one can deplete the gold reserves of the United States. So then, in 1971, Nixon and Kissinger they came up with this, and their treasurer department, let's announce that the dollar is no longer, or the gold is no longer, the dollar is no longer convertible to gold. So that, and then they forced that decision upon their European allies, which is that's the second largest reserve of currency. So from 1971, the countries started, and on countries in the world, one after another, started deviating or going away from the gold standard. Until recently, which is by now, like as we speak today, well, there was a time the Soviet Union, during the Cold War, continued to support the gold standard for what is called the gold ruble. So they had two currencies, one internal and one external. The internal ruble was trash, just any papers. The external for external commerce, it was supported by gold. But after 1990, when the Soviet Union collapsed, there has come no single country in the world that backs up its currency with gold. So currencies today, in reality, they can be trashed overnight with a one decision. Like any country can simply go and say, I want to devalue my currency. My currency today stands, let's say, the rate of $1 versus, let's say, 0.7 Jordan dinars. Now Jordan comes out and says, okay, I want to devalue my currency. Then out of a sudden, the currency becomes worth maybe 10 cents a dinar, which goes into trash. Like what happened in Iraq after 1991, the first war against Iraq. Then Iraq devalued its currency to, before the war, one Iraqi dinar used to cost about to value around $3. After the war, one dinar is valued about $1,000.
Ooh!
So it's absolutely worthless. Now, if the dinar was backed by gold, no way they can do that, because if I have a dinar, then I can always replace it with gold wherever I go.
Yes.
So the gold standard was the check and balance, the one that checks the economies. Economies cannot grow, I mean, money, wealth, cannot grow faster than what the economy grows, and the economy will not grow faster than what the country can provide in terms of gold return.
Right. Well, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't this one of the things that Colonel Gaddafi was trying to do?
Well, true. Colonel Gaddafi, he used to speak about the gold standard in the sense that it is something needed, but he really never did any serious attempts to change or to transfer his wealth into, because he had a huge amount of wealth, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
He never attempted to get gold to back up his Libyan dinar or Libyan currency.
Wow.
The only one who once tried seriously was de Gaulle of France, Charles de Gaulle, back in the early 70s. But I think that, again, he couldn't stand in front of the American capitalist machine. It's a huge.
You're right.
I mean, this requires, to get back to the gold standard, as I say in my book, it requires a new state, new type of ideology, something that a state that can accept the challenge of the so-called the dollar challenge and can proceed. It's difficult. It's not easy, but it needs determination. It needs someone who has a vision and has determination and can force his own currency into gold. When the economy grows, that country has a strong economy, then they will enforce this upon other nations. But currently the way it stands, with the United States being as powerful as it is, when the capitalist machines with the banks, with the Federal Reserve, I think they stand strongly against this issue. And that's where I say is the economic stability will never happen, will not happen until and unless you come back to the gold. Now, mm-hmm. capitalism will not go back to the gold because it's against the greed. The greed is there. And therefore, the trends or the cause that is causing the crisis, the most recent crisis, will continue. So it's not something, the magic solution is there, but no one is going to do that magic solution.
Right. Well, now, tell me about the components of Islam that connect up with this.
Well, in Islam, see, here is an issue. Many people look at Islam as, even Muslims, as religion where people have mosques and they pray and they do charity.
Right, only as the ritualistic.
Right, even although in the part of the rituals, there is a component of the rituals that has to do with an obligatory charity.
Right.
Which means we have to pay 2.5% of our wealth to feed the poor. But that is not what the economy of Islam is about. Economy of Islam, from the origin, it looks at the following things. Number one, Islam has a definition of ownership. Who owns what? In capitalism, free enterprise is the king. Under socialism and communism, public enterprise, public ownership, which is the everything is owned by the public. And which is the old Marxist theory, is each person provides as much as he can, and he takes from the society as much as he wants, as much he needs. And then socialism changed that to you provide as much as you can, and you take as much as you produce. But anyway, Islam says, in reality, each society must have three types of ownerships, which have to be categorized and well-defined. Number one is the private individual ownership. Individuals, people, men, women, they must have some certain access to some resources to own them, and they should be their own. Like, say, my apartment, my clothing, my own car, my my living stuff, these are mine.
My books.
My book, yeah, it's mine. That's just example. There is the something which should be owned by the multitude, by all. Should not be. No individual should own rivers, oceans, beaches, forests, energy resources. Energy resources, because, and Islam says the energy resources and the water, because if you deprive a certain segment of the people from energy resources, they will disperse. They will just flee the place. They cannot live without energy, cannot live without water.
Right.
So in order to preserve the unity and the integrity of a society, energy resources, forest resources, and all the trees, the grasses, etc., and water resources, those have to be owned by all. Along these lines, there are the minerals which exist in large quantities, like gold, diamond, metals, iron, copper, uranium. All of these minerals should be owned by the group, which means by the whole country, not by individuals. Now, the state as such, it must have its own specific ownership so that it does not burden the individuals with taxes and does not tap into the public resources. And there are specific lands in the Muslim world or under Islam, specific types of land whose ownership belongs to the state. So the state owns them and allows the people to use them, but then the state takes revenue.
Now, what kind of lands would those be?
In the category there, each land in the Islamic world that has ever been annexed to the Muslim world through war, not through negotiations, this belongs to the state because the state had earned it. like when the Muslims first came out from Arabia, they went into Iraq and Syria. There were wars. It was not simply people negotiated and then they joined in. There were wars, and the state is the one that carried the war. So the state owns the land now. It's not individuals and it's not the public.
Okay.
So the state now has the property, the real estate belongs to the state for these lands. And the way it does it, it allows people to use the land to cultivate it, to farm it, but then there is a certain amount of money of revenue should go to the state budget.
Mm.
So in the past, this was a major revenue which is beyond the charity. Like we, as Muslims, if I have a piece of land and I cultivate it and I have some products, then I pay part of my products as charity. 2.5% of what I earn goes into charity. But beyond the 2.5%, the state owns, let's say, 10, 15, or 20, or even half of the revenue. That goes to the state. And that is a money where the state has its own budget in order to run its own affairs. And there are some other pieces. Let's say there is some called 20% of all the minerals which are located in pieces of land where the minerals are not big mines. Let's say if you have a small mine, it's not really huge, where the state does not want to burden the community with, they will say, okay, you use it, but give me 20% out of that. So there is, but then the state does not tax the people. I mean, I'm not going to pay the state tax because it does have its own money. So the state has money, the public has money, which is the, like today I was, in fact, I'm collecting as we speak, the total amount of oil and gas and minerals in the Muslim world or in part of the Muslim world. How much of that, if it's used, if this wealth is used in the benefit and the interest of the public, and the public here, all the citizens, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, as long as they are citizens of the state, this belongs to all. So that amount of wealth is way beyond what all the poor, not only in the Muslim world, but all the poor in the world need.
Right.
Now, the oil and gas today from Saudi Arabia alone, it sits in hundreds of billions of dollars in Swiss accounts and in U.S. accounts, and they are doing nothing.
Right.
But that wealth under the Islamic economy belongs to the nation, belongs to the whole nation. The second part, the second component of the Islamic economy is the gold standard. Islam does not allow any currency to be issued until and unless it's backed by gold. So it does not allow the currency to grow virtually. A third component, which is really in much defiance of what capitalism is, Islam does not allow people to sell what they don't have. Let's say I'm not going to do like they do the put and get on the market. Let's say I go and contract Germany and I'm going to build certain product, and I get their money before I have the product. That's not allowed. In Islam, you say you do the product first, you build your economy, and then you do the sale.
Ah.
You can't collect wealth on the anticipation that you are going to make a product. And that allows the people to really to force the people into productivity much more faster than they do it in any other under any other system.
Right. Well, that's the way they used to do, at least the ordinary people in this country.
Yes.
They used to save their money and buy a car for cash, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's that leads me to the last point, which is the interest. See, the interest in Islam, we call it usury, in Arabic it's called riba. Usury or interest on money is absolutely not allowed. Islam says you cannot allow the money to grow without products. Like I cannot give you a loan and get profit on the money itself. Money cannot make money on money.
Right.
If there is nothing, no product in between, money cannot grow. And that's a key a key problem with the virtual economy, how virtual economy comes. The Federal Reserve, actually the Federal Reserve provides loan to the U.S. government, $1 trillion, and then it charges them about maybe $200-300 billion interest. So now we have $1.2 trillion of money, but we did not produce the $0.2 trillion in products.
Exactly.
So we don't have products which match the money that the Federal Reserve now has. Islam does not allow this to happen. And that's what some people say, well, how are we going to finance then big projects? Well, projects will be financed by the money that we have. I'm not going to give you a loan to make a project. I can partner with you. If you lose, I lose. If you win, I win. But it's not that I'm winning anyway. I'm getting my money no matter what. Even if you file bankruptcy and you are dead, I go and take your life insurance money.
Yeah.
I have this example. One of my friends, he lost his very profitable producing machinery company. And then when the bank came after him, they said, oh, okay, you don't have enough to pay our interest. We will tap into your life insurance. Meaning that in reality, what this means is if his life insurance is $500,000, probably they will send someone to kill the guy and get his life insurance.
I wouldn't put it past them nowadays.
It's ridiculous in the way it's happening in the current systems.
Well, so and I didn't know all of these things. I knew that like the usury, the interest wasn't allowed, but I didn't realize that there were all these other pieces of that.
Also there is along those like the stock market. Now everybody, when the stock market is doing very well, everybody is happy. Because their stocks are growing. When the stock market crashes, everybody is sad, and you will have many people commit suicide because they lose. Supposedly, they had, let's say, a worth of maybe $100 million worth of stocks, and those $100 million are now zero. But they didn't own anything, really. Even the $100 million worth of stock was not real, was virtual. And the idea here is, this is where capitalism goes wrong, because capitalism is vague about defining the values of things. Capitalism allows the value to be relative, like the value of the tomatoes or the meat or the bread. It's always relative, and they talk about marginal values, and it's in the theory of economy, and they make it so complicated that people don't understand it. And they think it's so difficult. But in reality, at the end of the day, what they did is they allowed the value of things to grow or shrink based on the opinion of the world.
Yes.
Meaning, if today we create a public opinion about the stocks of Apple versus Samsung, and everybody starts talking more about Apple, then the stocks will grow, and the virtual wealth of Apple company will probably be doubled when we have not produced double the number of iPhones. Just simple example.
Yeah.
Or even General Motors or Ford. So you'll see the stock of Ford goes, let's say, double or triple when we have not produced that many cars. And that immediately tells us there is something wrong there.
Right.
Now,
right.
In Islam says, no, you can't have relative values. Values in Islam for the goods and the products are fixed. They are absolute values. And they have to be related to something that cannot be changed, that's static. And that's why, going back to the gold issue, we say each product, its value at the end of the day, whether it's a product or a service or a labor, has to be valued against something stable, which is, pick a metal. Gold is the most stable metal, or silver for that matter. So in this case, the value of companies, the value of economy will never be virtual. It will always be real. In the United States and in the capitalist world, today our economy, the way the Dow Jones and the Nasdaq, they say there are 14,000 points. 14,000 points are translated into numbers, and the number is translated into number of dollars. Mm-hmm. But in reality, the next day, if the number of points goes down, let's say, to 10,000, so we say, oh, we lost about 40% of our market. What do you mean 40% we lost? In the first place, we did not gain anything. We did not have products that we lost them. You lost numbers. Now, Islam does not allow this to happen. Islam does not allow the whole issue of stock values, which are relative. You must have a well-defined value for your economy, for your products, for your companies. It has to be measured against something real. And therefore, that's another element or component of stability of the economic of the Islamic economic system, which the world, many people don't know, of course, because as you mentioned earlier, they are happy with the style. There is a royal queen somewhere. We love the queen, therefore we must have a queen. We love capitalism, therefore we must have capitalism.
Well, okay, let me ask you, Muhammad, how we are speaking with, I should add, Muhammad Makawi, and he is the author of Fall of Capitalism and Rise of Islam. Where can we find this book?
Okay, there are two ways to find the book. One way is to go to Amazon.com, and it's there, or Kindle. And usually Amazon sells the book for relatively high price. Or they can call me and I can furnish a copy of the book at a reduced price, because I get my author price from the publisher.
Ah, so you want to give us a phone number?
Sure, yeah. I can give a phone number and an email. Do you want me...
Email would probably be better.
Yeah. The email, I don't know if you can post it on your...
Yeah, I'll post it. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I will write it down for you.
And send it to me, and I'll put it on our page.
Yes,
our KPO page on Facebook.
Yes, right. That will be the best thing. And then I can, as I said, I can get the book at a reduced fare.
Yeah.
And I'm planning to, again, I went with a publisher locally in the U.S., which is... it doesn't allow the book to be sold at a cheap price, which I think it should not be sold for more than $10.
Mm-hmm.
For people should afford it. So I'm looking for another publisher overseas, and overseas in the world. It's a global world, in India or in Malaysia or in Indonesia, where so I can make it more affordable to the people.
That's admirable, because I think that's one of the things that's happened in the U.S. I mean, it seems like a vicious circle. We've outsourced so much that we've outpriced our own companies.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. How many people who are Muslim actually know all of these things that you've been telling me? Because I've not heard all of this from anyone before.
Well, you know, as I said, unfortunately, during the last 90 years, the Muslim world fell under the British, French, and later on American colonialism. And the culture and the education system and the media has been orchestrated and designed carefully by secular capitalist type of colonialist mentality, where and therefore the ideas, the very practical ideas of Islam, things which are related to the life of the people, like the economy, the political system, the social system, mm-hmm. they have been very much undermined, very much. So they are not taught in schools, they are not taught at the universities, except very few. And in public, they have always been like, when we talk about the economy of Islam in a place in the Muslim world, it poses a challenge to the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, there is always some type of blockage. But nevertheless, during the last 3 years since the Arab Spring mm-hmm. started, there is more and more awareness of these political, economic ideas of Islam. There are more scholars who are addressing these issues. There are more opportunities for people like me and some other people who will give their lectures and talks at conferences to discuss these issues. So the awareness that happened during the last 3 years since the Arab Spring started probably is more than the awareness that took place over the last 6 years.
Wow. Okay, so, talk about speeding up, then it has.
Exactly. Yeah. And,
how did you get into this? Because like you said, you're a computer engineer.
This is the blessing of being going around the world when I am at young age. Mm. See, when I was in the United States at age 16 or 17 years old, I was exposed to this very shiny, bright, if you will, fast-moving capitalist world. And then 1 year later, I jumped into a place where it's so-called socialism or controlled type of economy. And then immediately that contrast started happening. So, and besides, the Soviets did a very good job in teaching us as students the concepts of political economy and the differences between capitalism and socialism. So that gave me a wealth of information and knowledge about what is not Islam. So then I started digging into resources and books and literature and history. Then I found there are some scholars, some writers, some people who really did a good job, but their work was not that famous. So I got, at least I educated myself in those areas. And there is one of the authors, his name is Nabhani, one of the scholars, Muslim scholars. He really wrote very strong books that explain socialism and capitalism from Islamic perspective that helped me at least understand the how the controlled economy works and how the free market economy works. Mm-hmm. And then I developed my style of knowledge. And of course, as a computer researcher, you know, once you have a PhD in computer, I think you can research almost any topic you want. That gives you the tools. Mm-hmm. So I have the tools of research.
Yeah. Well, and you do say in your book that you had been, just like we were talking earlier about a lot of Muslims, like Christians, I mean, they go to the mosque, they do the rituals. But when you were in Russia, you started to question things and get a deeper understanding of Islam. So even back then.
Oh, yes. Sure. Yeah. That was a big challenge for me, you know, because as a kid, when someone challenges your real faith, the core of my faith is that there is a God who creates the world. That's my core. And in the Soviet Union, they challenge that very core, that there is no God. It's not that there is a God who has nothing to do with the world, like what capitalists say. So there is no God. The world is eternal. World evolves by itself. So that's a direct challenge to my core faith.
Your core faith, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So now I had one of two things, either to accept what they say because they have convincing arguments, or to go to my faith and look for counter arguments. So I did the latter. So I went back to Islam and started looking what are the reasoning, if there is any, behind my faith. Is there any rational reasoning that supports my faith? And then I did find lots of evidences and intellectual proofs, intellectual reasoning that supports my core ideas. So then I started going into the classes and challenging my professors on the issue of material, historic or dialectic materialism. And that was a very interesting episode because you could end up in trouble if you do that. But I survived, hopefully.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, I did survive. I had some good teachers. One of my professors in philosophy. I still remember his name, David Diktiar, his philosophy. He approached me and he said, look, Muhammad, I know what you know, but what you know is too much for my students. Oh. So I allow you not to attend lectures. Don't attend my lectures. And if you need to discuss issues, I will discuss them with you on the side. And I was satisfied. I said, okay, fine. It's fine with me. So he would visit me at home in my dorm at least once a week. So we talk about the philosophy issues. But he doesn't want me to talk in front of the class. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So that was something I was proud always of. I know my ideas, the ideas I believe in,
yeah,
they have some intellectual support. I'm not a Muslim anymore because I was born in a Muslim family. I cannot afford to have that. It's that luxury of being a Muslim simply because I am from a Muslim world.
Sure.
You know, when you live in that part of the world, you no longer have that luxury. You have to prove yourself or get moving with the current crowd.
Mm-hmm. So now, yeah, you searched it out and you found things. You talked with him. So, I mean, you have a very firm foundation now.
Yes, I do. Yeah, and then, in fact, actually, I just spoke on this issue in Detroit. There was a conference on the intellectual framework of Islam.
I just came back from Detroit, and now, then, this coming week, you're speaking at Northwestern University in Chicago. Northwestern, not Chicago. So Northeastern University in Chicago.
Yes.
And you sometimes, you talk about Islam and terrorism.
Yes.
As a topic some places.
Actually, you know, believe it or not, after the events of September 11, when everybody was pointing finger at Islam because of the Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda issues, and all absolutely, without exception, Muslims, they were scared to even touch the issue of terrorism because they were implicated.
Right.
And I spoke immediately in November, I mean, September 11th were the acts, in November of 2001, and in October, actually, October and November and December, I spoke at three different universities, one at Marquette University in Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and one at Maryland, College Park University in Maryland, and the third in College of DuPage in Chicago,
mm-hmm,
on this issue, Islamic view of terrorism, because Islam does not sponsor terrorism.
Absolutely not. I know.
Yeah, Islam actually can be the solution to terrorism. And in reality, the main idea I am promoting is terrorism is a byproduct. It's not a cause. It's a product of something.
Mm-hmm.
Terrorism has an environment in which it grows, just like fungus. Fungus grows in an environment where there is lots of bacteria and lots of garbage and dirt. Terrorism is the same. It doesn't matter whether it's committed by a Muslim or non-Muslim.
Right.
It's an environment that allows this terrible thing to happen. Look at the environment. Who is creating the environment in which terrorism grows?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, for the last 50 years, the ones who control the world environments, they are not controlled by individuals. These are controlled by big intelligent organizations, by states, by United States, by Britain, by France, by Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the countries that control environments in the world, in Africa, in Asia, in Europe. They are these environments, they are not created or maintained by small groups. The groups actually, they grow just like fungus. They grow in environments which are controlled by these superpowers. So my point is that superpowers, any power that controls the world order is responsible for what goes in the world. If you cannot eliminate terrorism in the world order that you are maintaining, get lost. Leave the world order. Don't claim that you can maintain it. Just like in a family, if I cannot run my family affairs, if all my kids are on drugs, if my wife becomes some bad woman, I cannot run a family. I am in charge of my family. I'm not going to blame my kid who goes on drugs if the father is not there to, or he, if the father is a gambler.
Right.
So what I'm saying here is, look, the world is in terrible conditions. Lots of poor, lots of poverty, lots of wars, lots of conflicts. And those things are not being resolved. Palestinian case has been there since 1948. It's not resolved. The Kashmir between India and Pakistan is not resolved. The Kurdistan problem is not resolved. There are many issues. Poverty is not resolved. AIDS in Africa is threatening an entire continent. It's not resolved.
Right.
And there is a world order maintainer, which is the United States of America. It is in charge of world order. I'm not going to hold responsible the poor kids in Africa because they have AIDS.
No.
That's ridiculous.
Right.
I will hold responsible the one who is in charge of the environment of the world. Resolve poverty. Resolve the conflicts in Palestine. Don't allow Israelis to bombard people in Gaza or in demolish lands in the West Bank or evict people from their lands. Don't do that. Don't allow it. Don't allow the Spain to overkill people in the Basque. Don't allow that. Don't allow the Sahara in North Africa and Morocco and Algeria to be out of control. Don't allow the Somalis to be zombies. Or they're
all... It's state-owned and controlled, and the multi-corporations are...
Yes, of course. Yes.
So you can't really separate the multinational corporations from the states, but they are all responsible.
Yeah, I mean, well, states are run by multinational corporations.
Yeah.
I mean, the United States government is controlled directly by Federal Reserve. Obama, the poor guy, cannot generate money, budget, unless he gets loan from the Federal Reserve. If the Federal Reserve decides to shut down the loan, the whole government collapses.
Yeah.
So it's very simple. The formula is very simple. And if those big corporations, they want instability in the Middle East, the United States government will not say no because they are paid by them.
Well, they're making so much money. I mean, war is such a big moneymaker for these multinational corporations.
And they are not embarrassed by it. They are not shy. They talk about it and they publish books about it. Yeah. That the Second World War, it took a Second World War, which eliminated more than 40 million lives of people, to get the country out of the depression it was in, coming into after the 1929 crisis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They actually document the fact that the war did get us out of that. And they're not ashamed of that.
No.
I mean, why should I be ashamed of saying, look, you guys, you create wars, you create conflicts in order to get more money, and then you blame people to being terrorists?
Yeah.
That's not right.
The biggest terrorists on the planet are the states.
I think the government, especially the ones who are in charge of world order,
yeah,
whoever is that is, at the time when Germany controlled the world order for a couple of years, it created the environment for big terrorism. Then Britain did.
Yeah.
France did in North Africa. And then the United States in the entire world. And the Soviet Union did for the Eastern European camp at some time and for the Indochina area.
Right.
Anyone who is in control, I blame the one who is in control. I don't blame the one who is controlled.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that the one who is controlled, that does not justify a person blowing up a bridge or a building. That's absolutely not justified. That's wrong. There is no question about it. But to resolve the issue, the point is, how do you get rid of that? How do you get security and safety? You must eliminate the environment in which fungus or terrorism grows. I would call it as a fungus.
Exactly. I like that analogy very much, Mohammed. Dr. Mohammed Mokawi, Fall of Capitalism and Rise of Islam. And you can go to Amazon.com or shortly, within a couple hours, we'll have up his email address on Aramartefio page on Facebook. And my friend, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Ruthann, for hosting me, and I enjoyed it very much. You have been a wonderful host. And as you mentioned, next week, Friday, between 6 p.m. and 10 p.m., mm-hmm. we have this function at Northeastern University in Chicago. Okay. Everybody is welcome, and you are more than welcome to attend if you happen to be in Chicago.
Mm. I would be if I was going to be there then. I'm not going to be there then, but I'm looking forward to having coffee with you when I get there.
Sure, yes. Yeah. I will love to do that, yes.
So thank you so much, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Well, welcome back. I'm Ruth Aramar Tefio, and this is the second hour of Feed Your Head. We have with us Robert Graham. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Roseanne. How are you?
I am great. Robert is a sculptor, a painter, a man with very firm political views, I should say. And he can be found at www.robertgrahamsculptor.com. If you go there, you will see some fascinating paintings and sculptures. And you've also branched into furniture, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. What got you interested in furniture from painting?
Wasn't from painting. It was from sculpture.
Sculpture.
You know, yeah. I got all these damn tools that I've been collecting forever and ever, and it just seemed like, well, it was a natural thing to do, especially when I started making, I started studying bones and, well, the structure of things. Well, you know, the next thing you do is make a bed out of, make these big wooden bones, so... It was a natural.
Right. So it was
a natural fit.
Sculpture came first then.
Yeah, actually sculpture did come first. And that was a pretty interesting story because actually, sculpture did come first. And it happened actually when I was like 21 years old. I had a Bultaco Matador, which was an old enduro bike made in Spain, and I was out over in the anthills, and I was jumping my Bultaco on these hills, and I came down on the shift lever and broke it off, and there was a guy sitting there watching me do this, and he was on a 305 Honda Scrambler, and he said, well, why don't you just come on over to my studio, and I'll fix it for you. At that, I just take off and, you know, we go over there and, you know, I walk into this space that he, you know, he converted his double car garage into a studio, and I saw all these tools there, you know, drill presses and welders and grinders and, you know, tools. And so I was impressed.
Impressive word, huh? Did he let you play with things then?
Well, he actually, you know, he taught me how to gas weld. I mean, he was a really nice guy, and he was in the arts. I mean, he was making a little animal arts out of welded steel, and he taught me how to make a little owl, and I did.
That was your first piece then?
That was my first piece. You know, just
owl.
You know,
yeah.
The very next day, I go out and get me an oxyacetylene rig and a cracker box welder and a side grinder, and I'm in business. You know, I convert my garage into a studio and start making stuff.
Yeah. Well, one of I think it's not on your Facebook page. I believe it's on the website. There's some pictures of you at the bench. And
oh yeah.
Yeah, one of them. I love this one picture that someone snapped. You're sitting on the stool and you're looking. You look so pensive, like you're really wondering. You're looking at your piece there. And it would have been nice for you to have written what you were thinking about. I mean, it just looked like you were really into it and wondering, like, is it done or do I do this or that to it or whatever. I love that. Just the pictures of you working.
Yeah. I don't get to take pictures of myself working too often because I'm usually in the studio all by myself.
Right.
And, you know, that day I had my daughter, who's 14, that I had her take that picture so I could put it on my website. And, you know, that,
yeah. It was like, okay, I love that. Well,
yeah.
So did you just go then? I mean, like you said, you went out, you bought things, you were in business, you converted your garage. Have you been just making a living at this, or have you done other things, or what?
I am making a living at it now, but, you know, during the intermediate, well, in the very beginning, I didn't make a living at it. I was in landscaping, and then actually I went back to school in order to get my degree so I could teach. And then I did that, and I taught for a while, and now I'm back, teaching and just making my art.
Mm-hmm. So are you showing in galleries? How do you sell your work?
Well, I have a couple of galleries, and I'm preparing for a big show at a museum one of these days. But
in Houston?
And I've accumulated a lot of pieces, so I'm getting closer and closer to having that show. So
how many pieces do you think? I mean,
I've got hundreds.
Do you need then? How much would the museum have room for?
Well, you know, that's my aim, is to have a one-man show, and it takes hundreds of pieces to be able to pull that off. Because, well, especially in the last 20 years, I've just started making small stuff, that I can make in my own studio. Now, when I was at university and I was teaching at university, you know, I had a big studio and I could make big pieces. And then when I went to Japan and Italy, I could make big art because I had big studios. But I can't make big art anymore. Well, I guess I could if I had a whole team, but I'm not. I don't know. My muse tells me no.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the muse.
The material handling aspect of that is just too much.
Okay, that was what I was going to ask about. I mean, how big was your largest piece? And you had to leave it. I mean, when you were making these large pieces, you had to leave them in Japan and Italy and wherever you were.
Yeah. Well, not so much in Italy. I could make them in Italy and then send them back here, and that's what I would do. And the last time I went to Italy, I went to a place called Castellina in Chianti, and it was a commission piece, and I built this big piece inside a church that was, it was like 23 feet tall and about 20 feet in length and, about 8 feet deep.
Okay.
It was big.
Yeah, that's not just your ordinary little thing to ship back home.
That's right. And I built it all by myself. Well, I had some workers that helped me Well, basically, we'd sit down and have a bevy at lunchtime, you know, together, and that was about it. But I've learned how to make these big things in small little components and get up on ladders and put them together.
Okay. Well, did you ever, after you had some big piece made just to move it, did you ever like cut it down and move it in parts and then put it back together?
Nope.
No. Once it's welded, it's welded. Or
that's right. Yeah. Well, let's see. That's I did one big, huge iron piece for a big festival here in Houston, you know, back in the 70s. And, you know, it was this great big, huge iron star. And I did have to move it because it was like 35 feet tall, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. And I did have to cut a couple of the top pieces off.
Oh.
And then move it, and then I never welded it back. So.
Ah. So it's in two pieces somewhere?
Well, it's probably smelted now. It probably turned it into scrap, and I had stored it over at my dad's dental office, and then my mom, after he died, my mom sold the property, and you know, they just came and took the piece.
Oh, okay. Well, that was a big dental office.
Well, no.
Okay.
He had his, a backyard.
Well, what about that? Like, okay, you were welding. What did your family say when you first started out, or when you first started, like, making money at it? Your parents, what did they think?
Well, my father, and I've had, I had a rather strenuous relationship with him for quite some time, but he said, you're a mechanical genius. I don't know why you've decided to, be an artist.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, because he was a dentist, and, he did the mechanic parts of it, too, so... And, in retrospect, it's an irony that now I'm, using some of his dental cabinets and his operative chairs and in the studio now that I have a special little drawer with all of his dental tools that I use all the time.
Wow. Well, sure, because like you said, you were making huge things, but now you're making things smaller because you have a smaller studio. So you all of those strange little things. I don't know much about dentists. I've not I don't have that problem, so I don't have dentists messing around in my mouth. But I have pictures of all those little tools and things, and so that's great that you found another use for them.
Yeah, I do all the time.
And there's something so nice because, those were your father's, even though they were, used in a different way. But I wanted to ask, your paintings, you use, I don't know how you describe your paintings, the way you use the colors and things. I did post on my wall today the four pictures of the West Bank that you painted. This is predominantly red, folks, for obvious reasons. But when did you get interested in, like, the political aspect? Did your muse turn you that way? Or tell me about
absolutely.
You.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Talk about
well,
you.
It actually happened in, like, 1983. Okay. And, well, I was teaching at the university here in Houston at that time, and we had a garage sale that we were raising money for the university or the art department. And I was just sitting out there, and I was thumbing through some National Geographic magazines, and you know, there, I came upon this one page where they were talking about this Bar Igea in Pietrasanta, Italy, and where all these American sculptors got together and they, you know, they carved stone. And, you know, I had never, well, no, let's see, this was in 1983. And, well, in 1980, I was still in graduate school and I met this guy, a Japanese guy, Tomishi Honda, and he had invited me to go to a stone sculpture symposium in Japan. And Ooh. That's where I learned how to carve stone. Uh-huh. It was in 1980. And then, you know, 1983 comes along and, you know, I'm sitting there looking at a National Geographic and they're talking about carving stone in Pietrasanta, Italy. And, you know, I just so happens, I mean, here's my muse. I had an Italian student and she was there and we called the Bar Igea in Italy and talked to, you know, somebody that spoke English there. And, I set up a studio and a date to be there in July, and I got on a plane and went over there and carved stone for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Well, and during that time, I mean, while I was in the studio, I mean, here's this beautiful Lebanese woman who's also carving stone, and become a friend of hers, and she starts telling me all about what's happening in Beirut, in Lebanon. And, you know, God almighty, this was like all new to me. You know, I thought I was a pretty educated person, you know. Well, educated in the sense that I had my brainwashing here in the United States, and all my news was like, Nightline and the New York Times and, you know, whatever the mainstream media was preaching. And, you know, this was unbelievable what the information I was getting from her. And, well, she had invited me to come over there to go to Beirut. And I did. I went over there and found out what the hell was going on. And that's when I got my education. I realized these mainstream media conglomerates, corporate news, is all lies. I mean, whatever they're telling you, it is an absolute lie.
Yeah. But how did it feel? I mean, going from here, that was a great summer. You went over to Italy, you carved stone for 2 weeks, met this beautiful woman, and then went on to Lebanon, and then you saw what she had told you about. And, I mean, you weren't that far from the U.S., you know, that long. I mean, how did you feel when you found out?
Oh, I felt, absolutely betrayed by the education system here in the United States. And, you know, I mean, that's what's really driven me into the psychology of this information that is out there. And, you know, it's driven me to find out what the truth is, what truth really is.
Yeah.
And you know, ever since, I've been trying to emulate that into my work. And you just saw it in West Bank.
Yeah,
you know?
Because it was
the struggle.
That struggle. I mean, that was just like the perfect color. It's got to be red. You use the word betrayal because I know that that's the only word I could come up with. You were awakened much earlier than I was. I was just in denial and things didn't make sense to me. But I kept, you know, just wanting to believe that the U.S. government couldn't be so horrid. And finally, you know, I took my head out of my butt. It was like, oh boy, yeah. And betrayal, that's the perfect word. I just think everything I was taught, you know, and I can't really blame my instructors, Robert, because they really didn't know any better either.
That's right. But, you know, until I actually went over there and saw with my own eyes and smelled with my own nose and realized that, you know, that, hey, there's a whole nother perspective out here,
yeah.
You know, and I agree, you know, I had good instructors, but, you know, they were brainwashed too.
Exactly. I mean, they believed the history books that they studied, and they taught us the way that, you know, and now, because of the internet and things, we don't, as much as I want to go to the Middle East, we don't have to go to these other places in person, because we talk with people in those countries on Skype.
Yeah.
We write to them back and forth. I mean, so we can see, they send us pictures. It's totally different than in 1983. I mean, we're talking 30 years. So.
Well, we didn't have internet then.
And until
we got the internet, and I mean, that was one of my seminal moments too. Is, you know, the first time I get internet, it's like, holy crap, man! There's stuff out there, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have to get it from Nightline and the lying New York Times anymore.
Yeah. That's one of the things that some of the people that I had. Well, I guess, trusted. I mean, on TV and all. I mean, I just keep finding out more and more. I threw my TVs out several years ago, so I don't have that. But, I mean, I hear enough about what these TV stations are still saying. And it's just, you know, these people are betraying the public because they're doing it for greed, because they know they aren't all that stupid. They have to know that, I mean, some of them must know. You know, what they're saying is lies, or they're not telling the whole truth. They're not allowed to. So there again, they're betraying the American people.
And absolutely.
And
it's not really them so much. It is the owners of all the mainstream media that won't allow them to report a story on GE or Westinghouse, or, you know, any of the arms manufacturers or the petroleum-based, they're not going to do it.
No.
So they can't talk about Monsanto.
Right, as much as we'd like. Because they say that our media and newspapers, all of this, I mean, mainstream media and the newspapers are all owned by about six corporations.
Four,
is it? Okay. Because today, I mean, I always heard six, and then today I saw somebody had said, might be three. And so they're all over.
They're going to get it down to one, I'm telling you.
They're working on that,
yeah. But
that's why we need, like, radio stations like this. We need the bloggers, people who are, you know, the artists, musicians, to do this. I mean, it's just a whole form of alternative media, because otherwise people aren't going to wake up. As long as they're sitting on their dead ass in front of that TV watching Fox News, you know, they're just not going to get it. And
they're not going to wake up. It's not earth-shattering enough, you know. And seems like the mentality of the media is just to keep, you know, everything calm.
Yeah.
As long as, I mean, I noticed that because I got real active after 9/11. I started joining groups and, you know, protesting. And, you know, it's like, I helped organize the biggest anti-war movement in Houston, Texas on January 15th, 2003, right? I mean, this is right before the war starts. And, there must have been like 12 million people out on the streets all over the world protesting the war that was going to happen in Iraq. And, you know, that's when I noticed, they ain't covering this. They are not covering this. The mainstream media did not cover it. And, you know, and then, you know, the John Q. public out there, you know, he didn't see it. You know, it must not have happened.
They're watching whatever on TV about some movie star or something.
Yeah, so, celebrity worship of some kind.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what, you know, the dumbing down of America has taken that kind of a side thing for sports and the celebrities in whatever field, whether it's movies or the sports, whatever, and they make such a big deal about them. This is what media does. So people really don't, you know, and I've had people tell me, well, oh, I know bad things are going on, but no, even people who are online, they say, well, I don't want to see those pictures. Why would you put up those pictures of those dead kids? And it's like, well, you know, you need to see them. And it's like, well, no, 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 I know bad things are happening, but, you know.
Yeah, right.
I want to put it in their face. I don't put it on their walls. I mean, I'm very courteous. I put it on my own. But people don't, they're more comfortable with their head buried.
Well, yeah, they don't want to. They just soon die as to know that if they knew that their government was lying to them, I don't want to know. I just soon die. You know,
they don't want to because once there's a part of them that understands that once you know the truth, you as a responsible human must do something.
You have to take action. That's right.
And so, you know, I think that part's battling with the part that says, well, there's nothing I can do anyway, and, you know, I just don't want to know about it.
Right.
And that's very frustrating. Have you had any kind of reactions, good or bad, to something like West Bank? I mean, when you put the name out there, so people know your politics that way with through your...
Yeah, I had one piece over at a museum that was in a group show, and it was called Death to Usrael, U-S-R-A-E-L. And, they had gotten phone calls that they were going to burn the museum down.
Ooh, Robert.
Well, okay. You know, and the worst part of it is I got crap from, you know, my artist buddies, you know, oh, no, you can't name it like that. You know, and what it was this was right after in Afghanistan, where they had uncovered the bodies that, you know, that when Dostan, you know, that drug lord who was, you know, from the Northern Alliance, had taken all those, the ones that the CIA wouldn't take to Guantanamo. Well, they had collected a whole bunch of Afghanis and, you know, anybody they could round up, right?
Right.
Male over 25, and put them in these cargo containers, and then, you know, when the CIA wouldn't buy them, they murdered them right there in these cargo containers.
That just
and then they had to dump the bodies, and then, you know, here. Well, this was a couple of years ago when I did this piece, and, you know, it was the excavation site, and, you know, I had body parts and all sorts of strange stuff in there that, you know, look like an excavation site, and, you know, they just didn't like this piece at all. But, you know, Ruth Ann, I mean, that's when I feel like I'm doing my job.
Exactly. That's it. I mean, if everybody loves this, we're not doing our job.
And, that's right.
You know, I keep getting problems with Facebook, and so do you. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, I just take that as a good sign. And as frustrated as I get, I just smile and say, okay, you know, it's working. So that's I don't care if people are mad at me. I just want them to think.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm beyond that. You know, I mean, we grow up, you know, hoping people like us and all this. And, of course, I mean, people I don't think ever totally grow out of that. But on the other hand, when there's so much happening, I would rather somebody would really be angry with me and then maybe question me or question themselves why they're angry. And maybe the light bulb could go off. It's okay.
Yeah, because what I'm trying to do is, you know, like I use the word betrayal when you ask me about that, is to, for them to understand that they have been betrayed. And maybe they will, at that point, they will take action because, look, I showed you, you know. I mean, understand this, you know, what this event was all about. and you know, I mean, the one that's gotten me in the biggest trouble is 9/11. I mean, oh my God.
Oh, yeah. A couple of my relatives sort of stopped speaking to me about that.
Yeah. Well, I've got a sister that. They don't want to hear it.
No. These were cousins, and he had been in the service, and you know, I mean, at one point I had asked him. I said, "What do you think about it?" He said, "Oh no. You know, it'd be so hard to keep a secret like that." And no. Our government
right.
didn't have anything to do with it, and on and on and on. And then when I started coming out more and more, you know, he and his wife stopped talking to me. So, well, you know, there you have it. I think a lot of that was because he had been in the service and thought that the murders that he did, that it was an honorable thing. Or it's very hard, I think, for somebody who has gone and fought and under the banner of fighting for democracy, which that phrase makes me want to throw up in my mouth. But, you know, they go and they do that, and then they come back and find out that everybody doesn't consider them a hero. And it's like, but I was fighting for you. And I tell people, you're not fighting for me. You're fighting for some corporation. You're not doing jack for me. You're murdering my friends' families. Okay, is what you're doing.
Yeah.
So but I think that they don't want, there again, it's another form of, or another area of the denial. They don't want to, they just can't grasp that they're part of the problem, that they are not, that they were lied to, and that they're not part of the solution.
Right.
They went with their guns and drones and whatever to bring democracy.
I mean, Ruthann, they don't want to admit that they've been lied to, you know, betrayed.
Think they've been a sucker, but, which was probably part of mine when I was still in denial, but it's like, I admit that I was in denial, and I admit I was a sucker. I mean, because I just could not get my head around the fact that this government that I thought would always take care of me and, you know, the American people could have done any of this stuff and was still doing it and is still doing it. But
absolutely. I think they're getting ready to ramp it up because,
think
about it. I mean, they get away with the Kennedy assassination. They get away with the, Grenada, Panama, Iraq again. And 9/11, and you know, I mean, well, what's what's stopping them from doing?
Collapse
the economy of the whole world.
Well, and then you go back to the USS Liberty when this country covered up for Israel that was trying to sink our ship and kill all these men, but no, we covered up for them. And so, you know, all of that, and people just don't know that. And
it's like even if they do, they're still they basically are in denial because they won't believe you that it happened.
Yeah.
You know, the Israelis must not have known that, you know, that was an American flag flying from that ship, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and it was very obvious, and when you find out the whole history, and you talk to a couple of those survivors, and you know, they say, well, yeah, like the there was a ship coming to help them, and then Johnson made it stop and turn around, so they weren't rescued for hours later than they should have been, and all the time they were under fire, and you know, all of this, it's just yeah, don't talk to me about Lyndon Johnson. Well, you already mentioned the Kennedy assassination, and God knows who all was involved in that. But
it's the same people that were involved in the, you know, the 9/11 and everything else.
Yeah.
And that's what's, you know, that's what's startling. I mean, once you start going down the rabbit hole, you know, how deep? Did you watch any of that wake-up call
I watched part of it, and then I had to stop, and I did post it. And sure, yeah, I know. And I was I know I've seen parts of this before, here and there. And yeah, I will put it on Aramarte Fio Facebook page, because it's really worthwhile. It's 2 hours and 29 minutes. People sell popcorn. But
but it's worth it. It's in three parts. You can take a break.
Yeah.
I mean, when it starts off with that, you know, the not Terminator, what, the Matrix, and you know, the red pill or the blue pill. You know, I mean, this is where we are as a society right now. You know, I mean, where do you want to? How deep do you want to go down the rabbit hole and find out what's really going on?
Well,
is it important to you?
But once you start down that, okay, you can never go back, for one thing. And you just, all of these other branches are all connected. And my friend Cynthia Hamill, she actually has a show on the station called The Research Rabbit Hole with Cynthia Hamill. She got interested in, well, she's really almost like an expert with the chemtrails and 9/11. But she talks about the connections. And it's amazing. But like you say, I mean, once you go down there, you know, you can't undo it. You can't go back to being just another dumbed-down American.
Right. I mean, because if you do, you're really in denial. And, you know, I mean, then at that point, you said a lot of drugs and alcohol and everything else that mainstream wants you to do.
Wants you to, exactly.
That's the only way you can anesthetize yourself to feel like, you know, that you're you can't be a human being anymore.
Right. And you know, they talk about this war on drugs, and that's another one of those phrases. You know, there's several phrases that just make me ill. If we had a war on drugs, we would be actually trying to help people instead of guarding the poppy fields in Afghanistan so they can make more heroin.
That's right.
You know, it's like when you start to find this stuff out, this would be such a horrible B-grade, I say Z-grade movie or something, or book, if it were written out. And, you know, we would laugh and say, where did these people get these ideas? But it's all real.
I mean, they even write about it. I mean, the Project for a New American Century. I mean, they just spell it out right there, you know, right in plain sight where we can all see it. And, you know, here's their plan.
Yeah, PNAC. It's there. But people still want to be in denial. Well, I mean, most of the people have never heard of PNAC. But, I mean, the ones who are in denial. But even I don't know. That's why we have to keep trying.
Ruthann, that's the problem. They've never heard about it.
Yeah.
You know, they're not educated. Or, you know, I mean, they've got, maybe they've got a PhD from Harvard. I don't know, but they're not educated.
No.
They've been trained. And, you know, some of the, you know, one of my best friends is a Harvard lawyer, and he's the dumbest motherfucker. Yeah, I know, because he's so brainwashed into, you know, well, this is the way it is.
He wasn't trained to think for himself. He was trained.
Right.
He, like, knowledge was put in his head so he could pass his exams and do his job as an attorney. But to think for himself and do his own research on these little things that are around, no. But that's why, you know, alternative media and the social networks and things are so wonderful, because it just takes, I mean, I've had people write me and say, wow, I got it. Like that last post you posted about such and such, I got it. Now I know what you've been saying.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, okay, it's taking you a couple years, but good. I mean, the light bulb went off. And that's the whole thing. You never know what's going to do it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You have to just keep talking with people one-on-ones and in groups, whatever. And like you're artist friends who are all upset with you, did they get over it? Did they listen to you?
Well, I don't know. You know, at some point you just say, well, fuck it, I don't care. You know, I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing and keep putting it out there. I mean, well, I'll give you one instance when, you know, I'm out there busting my ass, right? I'm trying to put this stuff out there, and here was a couple of years ago. Well, Obama had been in office for a year, and, you know, I didn't like this guy from the moment, you know, from the get-go.
And I told people he was a liar and blah, 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 and he said, oh, he's the answer to everything, and it's like, okay.
You know, here, you know, 3 days after he's in office, he's got these goddamn drones killing Pakistani children, right?
Yeah.
I got active back when Bush was, or right after 9/11, I got very active, and, you know, I collected over 2,500 signatures to impeach this guy, right? Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, here comes Obama, and holy crap, we have some bridges over a main interstate here in Houston, and, you know, there's like 60,000 cars that pass an hour over this area, and a group of us, we started this back in 2006 after the invasion of Lebanon, and we went out there every Wednesday and took our signs and whatnot, and, you know, and here it is 2008 and or 9, well, it was 8, right, when Obama's in there, oh, it's 2009, and I bring my sign out there that says impeach Obama for war crimes, and, you know, and here's my group, you know, I helped found this thing and had been out there every Wednesday for over, well, 2 years.
Wow.
And, you know, they say, oh, you can't show that sign here.
Really?
And they pick up their signs and abandon me, leave me on the bridge by myself.
Ah.
With my impeach Obama sign.
Okay. They were afraid they were going to be jailed. Did you get jailed?
No.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. They can't, you know, you're right to protest. And,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But they didn't stop them from calling me a misogynist, stop them from calling me a racist.
That's like one of those words of last resort, because anybody that knows me knows I'm not a racist, and very few people have ever tried to call me that because they know my background and my friends and everything. But that just, you know, I have very good friends who are black who cannot stand Obama. So,
oh, yeah, me too. Me too.
So let's not even, you know, it's not, but people, they'll use that.
Oh, yeah. They start calling you names when they can't intellectually deal with the argument. You know, why can't we bring impeachment proceedings against this Democrat, liberal, a black man, you know, when we were all too willing to impeach Bush and Cheney for, you know.
I mean, people still want to try them for war crimes, and it's like, fine, but you put Obama right there with them.
That's right.
That's, you know, one of the most, for me, weirdest mornings in my life was I had gone to sleep with the radio on, and I woke up and I heard them talking about Obama had been given the Nobel Peace Prize. And I thought that these, there were a couple radio people, I thought that this was a joke, right? You know, I started, I was waiting for the punchline, and when it actually dawned on me that this had happened, I can still remember the feeling I had in my gut. It was just, okay. It's really, you know, these people are deluded somewhere. And then later I found out that at the beginning, several of the people didn't want him to have it, but one or two people talked to, I guess there's only 5 people that make up their minds, but there had been some coercion going on, supposedly. But, you know, wouldn't you think that if somebody actually was given that they would almost try to live up to it?
Well, I think that was the idea behind the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, why they've given it to, some of these war criminals before, in order to, you know, where they could at least make a correction, right?
Yeah.
You know?
A
wishful thinking kind of a
really
a prize.
Right. And they had, evidently, the people on the committee had believed some of his bullshit about what he was going to do. And do you remember how he was going to close Gitmo?
Oh, yeah.
That was his first act. That was going
to
be...
What did he say? What did he say? Close. You can take that to the bank.
Yeah. We have just been lied to and lied to and lied to. I mean, we were lied to by our teachers, just by society in general, because they didn't know any better. And
why are we set up to believe these lies? That's what I question, and that's what my art is about. Is, you know, why do we? Why does the population out there, why are they set up to believe these lies? You know, is it like the original lie of, religion or Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny or, you know, all these
all of that
we're trained with?
Well, we're taught to believe those in authority.
Mm, there it is. Yeah.
And you know, like when I was a kid, well, the policemen, and policemen were the good guys. When I was growing up, I grew up in a small town, and actually the police, they were good. I mean, they had their own, like one of them was having an affair with my neighbor lady and all this. But I mean, as far as, you know, they would, my parents had a mom and pop grocery store and got held up and the cops were there. And, you know, I mean, they always came, and police have always come when I've called them. So on a personal level, I don't have, you know, I haven't had these experiences some of the occupiers had with the, you know, being sprayed and everything. But right now, I know people who don't anymore teach their kids that cops are the good guys, because so much has happened and they've seen so much of this police brutality. And even though we know it's not all of them, but enough for people, they're not telling the kids, you know, if you get away from me in the mall, run over to that security guard or to that policeman or somebody in a uniform. They don't tell them that anymore.
Nope.
And it's really, it's sad.
Well, because, you know, what if the police become? And that's what we can discover by studying the Wall Street, or Occupy Wall Street, is they have become the enforcers of policy of, you know, what's the policy? You know, it's that the bankers run this country. They own this country. That's their money. And, you know, and we're going to have the police, just like, you know, what happened in Greece and it's going to happen in Italy here shortwith. But, you know, when the police are going to come out and enforce the policy of the authorities or the people that own this place.
Right.
And a whole lot like George Carlin said, you know, I mean.
he had a lot of good stuff, and, you know, we see a lot of that on Facebook. People are posting different things from George Carlin. But what is amazing is so many of the police, like during the whole Occupy incidents and things, the police didn't get it, that they should be on the side of the occupiers, that they are not part of the 0.1%. I mean, you know, and as enforcers, you know, they're just numbers also to those people who are.
Yeah, they see them as just, well, they're paid henchmen or that's all their job to do. I mean.
Well, they're afraid. People are afraid, especially in an economy like this, they're afraid to lose their job.
Yeah. Or they got a mortgage, right? You know, they got stuff that they're protecting.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's how we're all going to get divided into smaller and smaller groups.
Well, and that's what they're trying to do, is divide people. And they love all this, the whatever kind of division they can cause, whether it's with the religion, politics, anything. I mean, we have a unit party in this country, and, you know, to pretend different is crazy. Our third party have the money to...
What do you call what kind of party?
A unit party?
Unit party, yeah, okay, yeah. One party, Yeah.
Republicans and Democrats are so similar. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, they're all major capitalists, and
yeah.
money is God for them. So there you are. But our third parties don't have the money. You know, one of the things we need to do somehow is to take money out. And, you know, spending $1 billion on an election campaign is really stupid, especially when they already know who's going to be selected, that kind of thing.
Or does it even matter anymore? I mean,
that's it.
I mean, you're only voting for the lesser of two evils anyway, and they're both evil. So
they're both evil, yeah. And that was one of the big things during this last election. You know, people would say that, and then somebody else would say, "Well, you know, you're voting for evil if you vote for one of them, so vote third party." And then there were the people in the swing states that said, "Well, we can't," and Romney would be worse, so I'm going to vote for Obama, even though I can't stand him. And I mean, because I had friends who were doing that, and it was quite interesting.
Well, I'm there in Texas, and it was even worse, because, you know, there were third-party candidates here, right? And, you know, and Romney was going to win Texas no matter what. And they still wouldn't vote for a third-party candidate. They still voted for this loser. Oh, my God, I couldn't believe it.
You could not tell
them that, you know, that their vote was just being wasted. And I said, oh, no, your vote's being wasted if you vote for a third-party candidate. They're never going to get elected.
Well, the thing is, if there's more votes for third parties, at least we're sending a message that we don't like the uniparty. And we do have some options, so they should listen to us. But we have to get more people doing this.
Right.
And you're involved in the Green Party, I believe.
Yeah, I was. And actually, I pulled out of that too.
Did you?
Yeah. Because I just see the elections as, I feel like it's giving consent. You know, mm-hmm. giving consent that these elections are bona fide, and they are not.
No, they're not.
Third party candidate. They're right in a way. You can't. They're not going to win. But, you know, I'd love to support them, but my support is doing is giving the consent over to the majority that, you know, that this two party system is working.
Well, I think that the place for the third parties right now is on local levels. And independents have won some things, and some third-party people have locally. So, I mean, I tell people if your background will allow the check and you feel like you have the energy, run for something, whether it's school board, city council, something, but start with the ground floor, with grassroots. That's where we're going to make some changes. It's amazing what you can actually do in one community.
Well, the lesson of the moral majority, I mean, that's how they got into power in a big way. I mean, they started, you know, these evangelicals, they started going after the school board, and, you know, they got some power. But, I don't have much faith left in the liberals anymore, or what they even call a progressive. I mean, these people are so fractionalized. I mean, you try to do something, and they're going to call you a misogynist. Or
well, no, progressive and liberal to me, it's definitely middle of the road. They're like Obama, who is supposed to be on the left, who has moved to the conservative side. That's why those of us who are radicals, anarchists, whatever. We do not use the terms liberal or progressive for ourselves, because we've so past them to the left.
That's right.
You know, those words are nothing. A friend of mine was saying something about being progressive, and, you know, I said, well, you know, to me that's just another dirty word. It means you're in the center somewhere with the conservatives like Obama, the capitalists over there. And she was sort of shocked. She said, really?
You'll vote for anybody. Yeah.
She said, I guess I should stop using that term for myself. And I said, probably. It would just depend. I mean, other people would think, well, yeah, okay, then that means that she's, as you say, you know, liberal, progressive, she's on the left, she's doing whatever. It's like, no more. It really doesn't.
Yep.
So.
You're endorsing an arch conservative, a warmonger, a killer, you know? In favor of torture, yeah.
Right. I mean, look. Oh, yeah. Well, like Gitmo is just. I'm blown away because like the Red Cross is trying to get some kind of decent medical care for all the guys in Gitmo that are on a hunger strike.
Yeah.
Seem to be running up against a brick wall. It's just like, let them go home. It's been 10 years.
Yeah.
That kid, the one who was 15. He's 25 or 26 now.
Uh-huh.
He's never had a chance. He's from Canada, for God's sake. He's never had a chance to be a teenager or a young man. Let these people go home.
Their intent, and Obama's intent, is to keep this enemy combatant alive. As long as there's a war on terrorism, they have to have. Just like, the things in Afghanistan when they went and rounded up these nobodies and, accused them of being terrorists, and they weren't, but, they needed some bodies. So,
they need bodies.
That's what they're serving for. I mean, that's what they're serving as, is a body in Gitmo, because we got a war on terror.
Right.
Really?
When we...
Wait a second. Yeah. Who did this 9/11 anyway? I mean, that's where it all starts. I mean, who are these people that are, why aren't we going after? Not one of them has paid any price for this.
I know. That's the strange. And, they've actually been indicted in, other countries have done things that, of course, are not, legally enforceable or anything. But it was Indonesia or Malaysia or some place had a thing and found, I believe it was Bush and Cheney, guilty of war crimes or something.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, good. I mean, it's true, and we know it has no legal anything, but it's nice to hear anyway. It makes us feel good. Because they are. But so is Obama.
Yep.
And our Congress.
Yep. Every one of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kucinich was a good guy, but... he bailed too, and that's what I accuse him of, and what I'm most frustrated by these Kucinich people that, he knew he was going to betray us all in the end and, endorse Obama. And
I think, though, he was a good guy, and, I mean, he really, though, got railroaded with that redistricting.
Yep.
And,
sure,
because that's it. If there's somebody that they think is going to speak out and actually get some public support, well, they will find a way to get rid of them.
Yeah. They did, just like they did Cynthia McKinney. And
exactly.
They'll do it to anybody else. He was a presidential candidate, and he was doing good, and then, kind of sucked up all the energy. Where, Ralph Nader was running at the same time. I mean, there was a split between Kucinich and the Ralph Nader people, and there was a real strong candidate there in Ralph Nader, but
But he didn't have the money.
He didn't get any momentum,
and he didn't have the money, and kissing corporate ass. And hey, what to do?
Well, that's what it is. I mean, that's why we got the government we deserve, is because, it's the money. Money talks and bullshit walks.
Exactly. Robert Graham, I want to thank you. You can find Robert at Bob Robert Graham on Facebook and see some of his paintings and sculptures. You can go to www.robertgrahamsculpture.com. And we'll put that on our Aramarte Field Facebook page also. And I want to thank you so much. You're a delight. And your work is really, really good. So I want people to check it out.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. I really enjoyed it.
And thank you. And have a great weekend.
Oh, you too.
Springtime.
All right. Talk to you too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
you'd like for everybody to go to www.com. Good luck. Night, everyone.